looking for a place to sit or stand. Big shots from Justice, the FBI, the Pentagon, the CIA, the NSA, the White House, and Capitol Hill were pressing for seats, all claiming that their best interests would be served if they could be present to watch the lynching of Joel Backman. When the defendant finally appeared in the tense courtroom, the crowd suddenly froze, and the only sound was that of the court reporter prepping his steno machine. Backman was led to the defense table, where his small army of lawyers packed tightly around him, as if bullets were expected from the mob in the gallery. Gunfire would not have been a surprise, though the security rivaled that of a presidential visit. In the first row, directly behind the defense table, sat Carl Pratt and a dozen or so other partners, or soon-to-be former partners, of Mr. Backman. They had been searched most aggressively and for good reason. Though they seethed with hatred for the man, they were also pulling for him. If his plea agreement fell through because of a last-second hitch or disagreement, then they would be fair game again, with nasty trials just around the corner. At least they were sitting in the front row, out with the spectators, and not at the defense table where the crooks were kept. At least they were alive. 8 days earlier, J.C. Hubbard, one of their trophy partners, had been found dead in Arlington National Cemetery in a contrived suicide that few people believed. Hubbard had been a former senator from Texas who had given up his seat after 24 years for the sole, though unannounced, purpose of offering his significant influence to the highest bidder. Of course, Joel Backman would never allow such a big fish to escape his net. So he and the rest of Backman, Pratt, and Bowling had hired Hubbard for $1 million a year because good old J.C. could get himself into the Oval Office anytime he wanted. Hubbard's death had worked wonders in helping Joel Backman to see the government's point of view. The logjam that had delayed the plea negotiations was suddenly broken. Not only would Backman accept 20 years, he wanted to do it quickly. He was anxious for protective custody. The government's lawyer that day was a high-ranking career prosecutor from Justice, and with such a big and prestigious crowd, he could not help but grandstand. He simply couldn't use one word when three would suffice. There were too many people out there. He was on stage, a rare moment in a long, dull career, when the nation happened to be watching. With a savage blandness, he launched into a reading of the indictment, and it was quickly apparent that he possessed almost no talent at theatrics, virtually no flair for drama, though he tried mightily. After 8 minutes of stultifying monologue, the judge, peering sleepily over reading glasses, said, "Would you speed it up, sir, and lower your voice at the same time?" There were 18 counts alleging crimes ranging from espionage to treason. When they were all read, Joel Backman was so thoroughly vilified that he belonged in the same league with Hitler. His lawyer immediately reminded the court and everyone else present that nothing in the indictment had been proven, that it was in fact just a recitation of one side of the case, the government's heavily slanted view of things. He explained that his client would be pleading guilty to only 4 of the 18 counts, unauthorized possession of military documents. The judge then read the lengthy plea agreement, and for 20 minutes nothing was said. The artists on the front row sketched the scene with a fury, their images bearing almost no likeness to reality. Hiding in the back row, seated with strangers, was Neil Backman, Joel's oldest son. He was, at the moment, still an associate with Backman, Pratt, and Bowling, but that was about to change. He watched the proceedings in a state of shock, unable to believe that his once powerful father was pleading guilty and about to be buried in the federal penal system. The defendant was eventually herded to the bench, where he looked up as proudly as possible and faced the judge. With lawyers whispering in both ears, he pled guilty to his 4 counts, then was led back to his seat. He managed to avoid eye contact with everyone. A sentencing date was set for the following month. As Backman was handcuffed and taken away, it became obvious to those present that he would not be forced to divulge his secrets, that he would indeed be incarcerated for a very long time while his conspiracies faded away. The crowd slowly broke up. The reporters got half the story they wanted. The big men from the agencies left without speaking. Some were pleased that secrets had been protected. Others were furious that crimes were being hidden. Carl Pratt and the other beleaguered partners headed for the nearest bar. The first reporter called the office just before 9 a.m. Pratt had already alerted his secretary that such calls were expected. She was to tell everyone that he was to be busy in court on some lengthy matter and might not be back in the office for months. Soon the phone lines were gridlocked, and a seemingly productive day was shot to hell. Every lawyer and other employee dropped everything and whispered of nothing but the Backman news. Several watched the front door, half expecting the ghost to come looking for them. Behind a locked door and alone, Pratt sipped a Bloody Mary and watched the nonstop news on cable. Thankfully, a busload of Danish tourists had been kidnapped in the Philippines. Otherwise, Joel Backman would have been the top story. But he was running a close second, as all kinds of experts were brought in, powdered up, and placed in the studio under the lights, where they prattled on about the man's legendary sins. A former Pentagon chief called the pardon a potential blow to our national security. A retired federal judge, looking every day of his 90-plus years, called it, predictably, a miscarriage of justice. A rookie senator from Vermont admitted he knew little about the Backman scandal, but he was nonetheless enthusiastic about being on live cable and said he planned to call for all sorts of investigations. An unnamed White House official said the new president was quite disturbed by the pardon and planned to review it, whatever that meant. And on and on. Pratt mixed a second Bloody Mary. Going for the gore, a correspondent, not simply a reporter, dug up a piece on Senator J.C. Hubbard, and Pratt reached for the remote. He turned up the volume when a large photo of Hubbard's face was flashed on the screen. The former senator had been found dead with a bullet in the head the week before Backman pled guilty. What appeared at first to be a suicide was later called suspicious, though no suspect had ever been identified. The pistol was unmarked and probably stolen. Hubbard had been an active hunter, but had never used handguns. The powder residue on his right hand was suspicious. An autopsy revealed a stout concentration of alcohol and barbiturates in his system. The alcohol could certainly be predicted, but Hubbard had never been known to use drugs. He had been seen a few hours earlier with an attractive young lady at a Georgetown bar, which was fairly typical. The prevailing theory was that the lady slipped him enough drugs to knock him out, then handed him over to the professional killers. He was hauled to a remote section of the Arlington National Cemetery and shot once in the head. His body came to rest on the grave of his brother, a decorated Vietnam hero. A nice touch, but those who knew him well claimed he seldom talked about his family, and many knew nothing of the dead brother. The unspoken theory was that Hubbard was killed by the same people who wanted a shot at Joel Backman. And for years afterward, Carl Pratt and Kim Bowling paid serious money for professional bodyguards just in case their names were on the same list. Evidently, they were not. The details of the fateful deal that nailed Backman and killed Hubbard had been handled by those two, and with time, Pratt had loosened the security around himself, though he still carried a Ruger with him everywhere. But Backman was far away, with the distance growing every minute. Oddly enough, he too was thinking of J.C. Hubbard and the people who might have killed him. He had plenty of time to think. 14 hours in a fold-down bunk on a rattling cargo plane did much to deaden the senses, for a normal person anyway. But for a freshly released former convict who had just walked out of 6 years in solitary lockdown, the flight was quite stimulating. Whoever killed J.C. Hubbard would want very much to kill Joel Backman, and as he bumped along at 24,000 feet, he pondered some serious questions. Who had lobbied for his pardon? Where did they plan to hide him? Who exactly were they? pleasant questions, really. Less than 24 hours earlier, his